Recorded Books presents Telegraph Avenue by Michael Chabon, narrated by Clark Peters.
Call me Ishmael. Ishmael Reed, probably. 1. Dream of Cream. A white boy rode flatfoot on a skateboard, towed along hand to shoulder by a black boy pedaling a brakeless fixed gear bike. Dark August morning, deep in the flatlands, hiss of tires, granular unraveling of skateboard wheels against asphalt. Summertime, Berkeley, giving off her old lady smell, 9 different styles of jasmine and a squirt of hecat. The black boy raised up, let go of the handlebars. The white boy uncoupled the cars of their little train. Crossing his arms, the black boy gripped his t-shirt at the hem and scissored it over his head. He lingered inside the shirt in no kind of hurry as they rolled toward the next pool of ebbing streetlight. In a moment, maybe, the black boy would tug the t-shirt the rest of the way off and fly it like a banner from his back pocket. The white boy would kick, push, and reach out, feeling for the spark of bare brown skin against his palm. But for now, the kid on the skateboard just coasted along behind the blind daredevil, drafting. Moon-faced, mountainous, moderately stoned, Archie Stallings manned the front counter of Brooklyn Records, holding a random baby, wearing a tan corduroy suit over a pumpkin-bright turtleneck that reinforced his noted yet not disadvantaged resemblance to Gamera, the giant mutant flying tortoise of Japanese cinema. He had the kid tucked up under his left arm as, with his free right hand, he worked through the 8th of 15 crates from the Ben Ezra estate. The records in crate number 8 favoring, like Archie, the belly meat of jazz, salty and well marbled with funk, Electric Bird, Blue Note, 1970. Johnny Hammond, Melvin Sparks's first 2 solo albums, Charles Kennard, Watu Wazuri, Prestige, 1971. As he inventoried the lot, Archie listened, at times screwing up his eyes, to the dead man's minty quadraphonic pressing of Aieto's fingers. CTI, 1972. Played through the store's trusty quadapter, a sweet gizmo that had been hand-dived from a dumpster by Nat Jaffe and refurbished by Archie, a former Army helicopter electrician holding 37.5%, last time he bothered to check, of a bachelor's in electrical engineering from SF State. The science of cataloging, one-handed. Pluck a record from the crate. Tease the paper sleeve out of the jacket. Sneak your fingers into the sleeve. Wader the platter out with your fingertips, touching nothing but label. Angle the disc to the morning light pouring through the plate window. That all-revealing, even-toned East Bay light, keen and forgiving, always ready to tell you the truth about a record's condition. Though Nat Jaffe claimed it was not the light, but the window, a big solid plate of Pittsburgh glass vaccinated against all forms of bullshit during the period of 60-odd years when the space currently housing Brooklyn Records had been known as Spencer's Barbershop. Archie swayed, eyes closed, grooving on the heft of the baby, on the smell of grease coming off Ringo Thielman's baseline, on the memory of the upraised eyes of Elsabet Getachew, as she gave him head yesterday in the private dining room of the Queen of Sheba Ethiopian restaurant, recollecting the catenary arch of her lip, the tip of her tongue going Addis Ababa along the E string of his dick, swaying, grooving, feeling on that Saturday morning just before the boots of the neighborhood tracked bad news through his front door like he could carry on that way all day, forever. Poor Bob Ben Ezra, Archie said to the random baby. I did not know him, but I feel sorry for him, leaving all these beautiful records. That's how come I have to be an atheist, right there, Rolando, seeing all this fine vinyl the poor man had to leave behind. The baby, not too young to start knowing the ledge, the cold truth, the life and death facts of it all. What kind of heaven is that? You can't have your records? The baby, understanding perhaps that it was purely rhetorical, made no attempt to answer this question. Nat Jaffe showed up for work under a cloud, like he did maybe 5 times out of 11, or be generous, call it 4 out of every 9. His bad mood, a space helmet lowered over his head. Poor Nat trapped inside with no way to know whether the atmosphere was breathable, no gauge to tell him when his air supply would run out. He rolled back the deadbolt, keys banging against door, working one-handed himself, because of a crate of records he had crooked up under his left arm. Nat bowled in with his head down, humming low to himself, humming the interesting chord changes of an otherwise lame-ass contemporary pop song, humming an angry letter to the slovenly landlord of the nail salon 2 blocks up, or to the editor of the Oakland Tribune whose letters page his anger often adorned, humming the first fragments of a new theory of the interrelationship between the bossa nova and the nouvelle vague, humming even when he wasn't making a sound, even when he was asleep. Some wire deep in the bones of Nathaniel Jaffe, always resounding. He closed the door, locked it from the inside, set the crate on the counter, and hung his gray on charcoal pinstripe fedora from one of 9 double-branched steel hooks that also dated from the days of Spencer's barbershop. He ran a finger through his dark hair, kinked tighter than Archie's, thinning at the hairline. He turned, straightening his necktie, hepcat wide, black with silver flecks, taking note of the state of box 8. Working his head around on the neck joints a few times as if in that creak of bones and tension lay hope of release from whatever was causing him to hum. He walked to the back of the store and disappeared through the beaded curtain, laboriously painted by Nat's son, Julie, with the image of Miles Davis done up as a Mexican saint. St. Miles's suffering heart exposed, tangled with a razor wire of thorns. Not a perfect likeness, to be sure, looking to Archie more like Mookie Wilson. But it could not be easy to paint a portrait of somebody across 1,000 half-inch beads, and few besides Julius Jaffe would ever contemplate doing it, let alone give it a try. A minute later, Archie heard the toilet flush, followed by a spasm of angry coughing, and then Julie's father came back out to the front of the store, ready to burn another day. "Whose baby is that?" he said. "What baby?" said Archie. Nat unbolted the front door and spun the sign to inform the world that Brooklyn was open for business. He gave his skull another tour of the top of his spinal column, hummed some more, coughed again, turned to his partner, looking almost radiant with malice. "We're totally fucked," he said. "Statistically, that's indeed likely," Archie said. "In this case, how so? I just came from Singletary."
Their landlord, Mr. Garnett Singletary, the king of bling, sold grills and gold finger rings, rope by the yard, 3 doors up from Brooklyn. He owned the whole block, plus a dozen or more other properties spread across West Oakland, retail, commercial. Singletary was an information whale, plying his migratory route through the neighborhood, taking in all the gossip, straining it for nutrients through his tireless baleen. He had never once turned loose a dollar to frolic among the record bins at Brooklyn. But he was a regular customer nonetheless, stopping by every couple of days just to audit, to monitor the balance of truth and bullshit in the local flow.
"Yeah?"
Archie said. "What's Singletary have to say?"
"He said we're fucked. Seriously, why are you holding the baby?"
Archie looked down at Rolando English, a rusty young man with a sweet mouth and soft brown ringlety curls, all sweaty and stuck to the side of his head, stuffed into a blue onesie, then wrapped in a yellow cotton blanket. Archie hefted Rolando English and heard a satisfying slosh from inside. Rolando English's mother, Aisha, was the daughter of the king of bling. Archie had offered to take Rolando off Aisha's hands for the morning, maybe pick up a few items the baby required and so forth. Archie's wife was expecting their first child, and it was Archie's notion that, given the imminence of paternity, he might get in some practice before the 1st of October, their due date, maybe ease the shock of finding himself at the age of 36 a practicing father. So he and Rolando made an excursion up to Walgreens, Archie not at all minding the walk on such a fine August morning. Archie dropped $30 of Aisha's money on diapers, wipes, formula, bottles, and a package of Nuck nipples. Aisha gave him a list, then sat down right there on the bus bench in front of the Walgreens, where he and Rolando English changed themselves some foul-smelling diaper, had a little snack. Archie working his way through a bag of glazed holes from the United Federation of Donuts. Rolando English obliged to content himself with a pony of Gerber Goodstart. "This here's Rolando," Archie said. "I borrowed him from Aisha English. So far, he doesn't do too much, but he's cute. Now, Nat, I gather from one or two of your previous statements that we are fucked in some manner. I ran into Singletary, and he gave you some insight." Nat spun the crate of records he had carried in with him, maybe 35-40 discs in a Chiquita crate, started idly flipping through them. At first, Archie assumed that Nat was bringing them in from home, items from his own collection he wanted to sell, or records he had taken home for closer study, the boundaries among the owner's respective private stocks and the store's inventory being maintained with a careless exactitude. Archie saw that it was all just volunteers. A Juice Newton record, a bad late Commodores record, a Care Bears Christmas record, trash, curve fruit, the bitter residue of a yard sale. Orphaned record libraries called out constantly to the partners from wherever fate had abandoned them, emitting a distress signal only Nat and Archie could hear. "The man could go to Antarctica," Aviva Roth Jaffe once said of her husband, "and come back with a box of wax 78s. Now, hopeless and hopeful, Nat sifted through this latest find, each disc potentially something great, though the chances of that outcome diminished by a factor of 10 with each decrease in the randomness of the bad taste of whoever tossed them out. "Andy Gibb," Nat said, not even bothering to freight the words with contempt, just slipping ghosts of quotation marks around the name as if it were a known alias. He pulled out a copy of After Dark, RSO, 1980, and held it up for Rolando English's inspection. "You like Andy Gibb, Rolando?" Rolando English seemed to regard the last album released by the youngest Gibb brother with greater open-mindedness than his interlocutor. "I'll go along with you on the cuteness," Nat said, his tone implying that he would go no further than that, like he and Archie had been having an argument, which, as far as Archie could remember, they had not. "Give him." Archie passed the baby to Nat, feeling the cramp in his shoulder only after he had let go. Nat encircled the baby under the arms with both hands and lifted him, going face to face, Rolando English doing a fine job of keeping his head up, meeting Nat's gaze with that same air of willingness to cut people a break. Andy Gibb, Nat Jaffe, whomever. Nat's humming turned soft and lullaby-like as the two considered each other. Baby Rolando had a nice solid feel to him, a bunch of rolled socks stuffed inside one big sock, dense and sleepy, not one of those scrawny, flapping chicken babies one ran across from time to time. "I used to have a baby," Nat recalled, sounding elegiac. "I remember. That was back around the time he first met Nat, playing a wedding at that Natra Fonda club up on Joaquin Miller. Archie, just back from the Gulf, came in at the last minute, filling in for Nat's regular basis at the time. Now, the former baby Julius was 15, and to Archie at least, more or less the same sweet freakazoid as always. Hearing secret harmonies, writing poetry in Klingon, painting his fingernails with Jack Skellington faces. Used to go off to the nursery school in a leotard and a tutu. Come home, watch Color Me Barbara. Even at 3 or 4 years old, prone like his father to holding forth, telling you how French fries didn't come from France or German chocolate from Germany. Same tendency to get caught up in the niceties of a question. Lately, though, he seemed to spend a lot of time transmitting in some secret teenager code, decipherable only by parents, designed to drive them out of their minds. "Babies are cool," Nat said. "They can do Eskimo kisses." Nat and Rolando went at it, nose to nose, the baby hanging there, putting up with it. "Yeah, Rolando's all right.
That's what I thought. Got good head control. Doesn't he, though? Archie said. That's why they call him Head Control Harry, right? Sure it is. Head Control Harry. You want to eat him. I guess. I don't really eat babies all that much. Nat studied Archie the way Archie studied the A-side of the late Bob Benezra copy of Kulu Se Mama, Impulse, 1967, looking for reasons to grade it down. So, what? You practicing? That the idea? That was the idea. And how's it working out? Archie shrugged, giving it that air of modest heroism. The way you might shrug after you had been asked how in God's name you managed to save 100 orphans trapped in a flaming cargo plane from colliding with an asteroid. As he played it off to Nat, Archie knew, felt like the baby-shaped ache in his left arm, that neither his ability nor his willingness to care for Rolando English for an hour, a day, a week, had anything whatsoever to do with his willingness or ability to be a father to the forthcoming child, now putting the finishing touches on its respiratory and endocrine systems in the dark laboratory of his wife's womb. Wiping a butt, squeezing some carnation through a nipple, mopping up milk puke with a dish rag, all that was mere tasks and procedures, a series of steps, the same as the rest of life. Duties to pull, slow parts to get through, shifts to endure. Put your thought processes to work on teasing out a tricky time signature from On the Corner, Columbia, 1972, or one of those more obscure passages from the Meditations. Archie was currently reading Marcus Aurelius for the 93rd time. Sort your way one-handed through a box of interesting records, and before you knew it, nap time had arrived. Mummy had come home, and you were free to go about your business again. It was like the army. Be careful. Find a cool, dry place to stash your mind and hang on until it was over. Except, of course, he realized, experiencing the full court press of a panic that had been flirting with him for months, mostly at 3 o'clock in the morning when his wife's restless pregnant tossing disturbed his sleep, a panic that the practice sessions with Rolando English had been intended, vainly he sought to alleviate, it would never be over. You never would get through to the end of being a father, no matter where you stored your mind or how many steps in the series you followed. Not even if you died. Alive or dead or 1,000 miles distant, you were always going to be on the hook for work that was neither a procedure nor a series of steps, but rather something that demanded your full, constant attention without necessarily calling on you to do, perform, or say anything at all. Archie's own father had walked out on him and his mother when Archie was not much older than Rolando English. And even though, for a few years afterwards, as his star briefly ascended, Luther Starling still came around, paid his child support on time, took Archie to A's games, to Marriott's Great America and whatnot. There was something further required of old Luther that never materialized, some part of him that never showed up, even when he was standing right beside Archie. Fathering imposed an obligation that was more than your money, your body, or your time, a presence neither physical nor measurable by clocks. Open-ended, eternal, invisible, like the commitment of gravity to the stars. Yeah, Nat said. For a second, the wire in him went slack. Babies are cute. Then they grow up, stop taking showers, and beat off into their socks. There was a shadow in the door glass, and in walked S.S. Mershandani, looking mournful. And the man had a face that was built for mourning, sag-eyed, sag-jowled, lamentation pooling in the spilt ink splash of his beard. "You, gentlemen," he said, always something elegiac and proper in his way of speaking the Queen's English, some remembrance of a better, more civilized time, "are fucked." "I keep hearing that," Archie said. "What happened?"
"Dogpile," Mr. Mershandani said.
"Fucking dogpile," Nat agreed, humming again. "They're breaking ground in 1 month's time."
"1 month,"
Archie said. "Next month. This is what I'm hearing. Our friend Mr. Singletary was speaking to the grandmother of Mr. Gibson Good. Nat said, "Fucking Gibson good."
6 months prior to this morning, at a press conference with the mayor at his side, Gibson G-Bad Good, former all-pro quarterback for the Pittsburgh Steelers, president and chairman of Dogpile Recordings, Dogpile Films, head of the Good Foundation, and the fifth richest black man in America, have flown up to Oakland in a customized black and red airship, brimming over with plans to open a second Dogpile Fang on the long-abandoned Telegraph Avenue site of the old Golden State Market, two blocks south of Brokeland Records. Even larger than his giant predecessor, near Culver City, the Oakland Fang would comprise a 10-screen cineplex, a food court, a gaming arcade, and a 20-unit retail galleria anchored by a three-story Dogpile media store. One floor each for music, video, and other books mostly. Like the Fox Hills Dogpile store, the Oakland flagship would carry a solid general interest selection of media, but specialize in African-American culture, in all, as Good put it in press conference, its many riches. Good's pockets were deep, and his imperial longings were married to a sense of social purpose. The main idea of a thing was not to make money, but to restore, at a stroke, the commercial heart of a black neighborhood cut out during the glory days of freeway construction in California. Unstated during the press conference, though inferable from the way things worked at the L.A. Thang, were the intentions of the media store not only to sell CDs at a deep discount, but also to carry a full selection of used and rare merchandise, such as vintage vinyl recordings of jazz, funk, blues, and soul. "He doesn't have the permits and whatnot," Archie pointed out. "My boy Chan Flowers has them all tangled up in environmental impacts, traffic studies, all that shit." The owner and director of Flowers and Sons Funeral Home, directly across Telegraph from the proposed Dogpile site, was also their Oakland City councilman. Unlike Singletary, Councilman Chandler B. Flowers was a record collector, a free-spending fiend, and without fully comprehending the reasons for his stated opposition to the Dogpile plan, the partners had been counting on it, clinging to the ongoing promise of it. "Evidently something has changed the councilman's mind," said S.S. Mershandani, using his best James Mason tone, arch and weary, hold the vermouth. "Huh?" Archie said. There was nobody in West Oakland more hard-ass or better juice than Chandler Flowers. And the something that evidently had changed his mind was not likely to have been intimidation. "I don't know, Mr. Mershandani. Brother has an election coming," Archie said. "Barely came through the primary. Maybe he's trying to stir up the base, get them a little pumped, energize the community, catch some star power off Gibson Good." "Certainly," said Mr. Mershandani, his eyes saying no way. "I am sure there is an innocent explanation. Kickbacks," he was implying. "A payoff. Anybody who managed, as Mr. Mershandani did, to keep a steady stream of cousins and nieces flowing in from the Punjab to make beds in his motels and wash cars at his gas stations without running afoul of the authorities at either end was likely to find his thoughts running along those lines. It was almost as hard for Archie to imagine Flowers, that stiff-necked, soft-spoken, and everlastingly correct man, a hero in the neighborhood since Lionel Wilson days, taking kickbacks from some showboating ex-QB. But then Archie tended to make up for his hypercritical attitude toward the condition of vinyl records by going too easy on human beings. "Anyways, it's too late, right?" Archie said. "Deal already fell through. The bank got cold feet. Good losses financing, something like that." "I don't really understand American football," said S.S. Mershandani, "but I am told that when he was a player, Gibson Good was quite famous for something called having a scramble." "The option play," Nat said. "For a while there, he was pretty much impossible to sack." Archie took the baby back from Nat Jaffe. "G-Bad was a slippery motherfucker," he agreed. Mr. Nostalgia, 44, walrus mustache, granny glasses, double extra large rain spooner, palm trees, sawgrass, woodies wearing surfboards, stood behind the day-glow patchwork of his $500 exhibitor's table. Across a polished concrete aisle and three tables down from the signing area, under an 8-foot vinyl banner that read, Mr. Nostalgia's Neighborhood. Chewing on a Swedish fish, unable to believe his fucking eyes. Yo! He called out as the goon squad neared his table. Two beefy white security guys in blue polyblazers and a behemoth of a black dude, Gibson Goods, private muscle, whose arms in their circumference were a sore trial to the sleeves of his black t-shirt. A little respect, please! Damn right, said the man they were escorting from the hall. And as they came near, Mr. Nostalgia saw that it was really him. 30 years too old, 20 pounds too light, 40 watts too dim, maybe. But him. Red tracksuit, a size too small, baring his ankles and wrists. Jacket waistband riding up in back under a screened logo in yellow. A pair of upraised fists circled by the words Bruce Lee Institute, Oakland, California. Long and broad-shouldered, with that spring in his gait, coiling and uncoiling, making a show of dignity that struck Mr. Nostalgia as poignant, if not successful. Everybody staring at the guy, all the men with pot bellies and back hair and doughy white faces, heads balding, autumn leaves falling in their hearts, looking up from the bins full of back issues of Inside Sports, the framed terrible towels with their bronze plaques identifying the nubbly signature in black Sharpie on yellow terry cloth as that of Rocky Blyer or Lynn Swan. Lifting their heads from the tables ranged with rookie cards of their youthful idols Pete Maravich, Robin Yount, Bobby Orr, with canceled checks drawn on long-vanished bank accounts of Ted Williams or Joe Namath, unopened cello packs of 71 Topps baseball cards, their fragile black borders, pristine as memory, and of 86 Fleer basketball cards, everyone holding a potential rookie Jordan. Watching this big, gray-haired black man they half-remembered, a face out of their youth, get the bums rush. That's the dude from the signing line. Was talking to Gibson Good. Got kinda loud. Hey, yeah! That's, what's his face? Give him credit, the poor bastard managed to keep his chin up. The chin, him all right, with the Kirk Douglas dimple, light eyes, the hands, Jesus, like two uprooted trees. Consider yourselves fortunate, gentlemen, Mr. Nostalgia called as they swept past his table. That man could kill you with one finger if he wanted to. Awesome, said the younger of the goons. Head shaved clean as a porn star's testicle. Long as he buys a ticket first. Mr. Nostalgia was not a troublemaker. He liked to smoke prescription indica, watch television programs about World War II, eat Swedish fish, and listen to the Grateful Dead in any combination or grouping thereof. Undoubtedly, sure, he had issues with authority. His father, a survivor of two camps, his mother, a marcher on Washington. Mr. Nostalgia, unfit to hold down any job requiring him to answer to a boss. Great as he might be in circumference, however, Mr. Nostalgia was only 5'6", almost, in his huaraches, and not quite in fighting trim. His one reliable move, if you hoped to base a style of kung fu on it, you would probably have to go with Pillbug. Mr. Nostalgia avoided beefs, quarrels, bar fights, and showdowns, foreign and domestic. He deplored violence, except in 1944 in black and white on television. He was a merchant of good reputation and long-standing who had forked over a hefty fee to the organizers of the East Bay Sports and Card Show, some of which money had gone to pay for the protection, the peace of mind that these goons in their blue blazers would, at least, in theory, provide. And peace of mind, face it, was not merely a beautiful phrase. It was a worthy ambition, the aim of religions, the promise of underwriters. But Mr. Nostalgia, as he would afterward explain to his wife, who would sooner eat a bowl of mashed Ebola than attend another card show, was deeply outraged by the rough treatment to which a hero of his youth was being subjected. for no reason other than having managed to ninja himself onto the floor of the convention center without a ticket. And so, on that Saturday morning in the Kaiser Center, Mr. Nostalgia surprised himself. He came out from behind the ramparts of his neighborhood, replete as a Vegas buffet with choice offerings in the non-sports lines that he had made a specialty and métier, among them a complete set of 1971 Bobby Sherman getting-together cards, including a very tough number 54. Mr. Nostalgia moved with a stately glide that had led at least one uncharitable observer over the years to remark, seeing him go by one of his floral numbers, that the Pasadena Rose Parade appeared to be missing a float.
"Wait up! Let me get the man a ticket," he called after the retreating security escort.
Gibson Good's bodyguard glanced over his shoulder for half a second, like he was verifying that he hadn't just stepped in dog shit. The goons in the blue blazers kept walking.
"Hey, yo," Mr. Nostalgia said. "Come on, hey, come on, you guys, that's Luther Stallings."
It was Stallings who came to a stop first, digging in, bucking his captors, turning to confront his redeemer. The familiar smile, its charm gapped and stained by drugs or prison dentistry, or maybe only by the kind of poverty that would lead you to try to skirt an $8 admission fee, put an ache behind Mr. Nostalgia's breastbone.
"Thank you, my good man," Stallings said, ostentatious, showing up the goons. "My dear friend."
Mr. Nostalgia supplied his actual last name, which was long, Jewish, and comical, a name for a type of cheese or sour bread. Stallings repeated it flawlessly and without the hint of mockery that it typically inspired.
"My friend here," Stallings explained, shouldering free of the goons like an escape artist shrugging out of a straitjacket, "has kindly offered to float me the price of admission."
A slight rise in intonation at the end, almost putting a question mark there, making sure he had his facts right.
"Absolutely," Mr. Nostalgia said.
He remembered sinking deep into a greasy Herculean seat at the Carson Twin Cinema, a Saturday afternoon 30 years ago, an elephant of joy sitting on his chest, watching a movie with a mostly black cast, it was a mostly black audience, called Nightman. In love with every single thing about that movie, the girl in her silver afro, the hand-to-hand fighting, the funky soundtrack, a chase involving a green 1972 Saab Sonnet, driven at top speed through streets that were recognizably those of Carson, California. The gear, tackle, and explosives carried by the bank robbers. Above all, the movie's star, loose-limbed, still, and taciturn like a McQueen hero, and with the same willingness to look silly, which was another way of saying charm. And indisputably, in 1973, a master of kung fu. It's truly an honor. The goons zoomed in on Mr. Nostalgia, training their scopes, scanning the green two-day exhibitor's pass hanging from a lanyard around his neck. Faces going dull, losing some of their bored swagger as they tried to remember if there was anything about this type of situation in the official goon manual.
"He was harassing Mr. Good," said Good's bodyguard, stepping in to shore up morale in the muscle department. "You buy him a ticket," he told Mr. Nostalgia, "he's just gonna harass him some more."
"Harassing," Luther Stallings said, wild with incredulity, innocent of every crime of which he ever had or ever would be accused for all time.
"How am I harassing that man? I just want to get with him, have my 30 seconds at his feet, standing online like everybody else, get my autograph off him, go about my way."
"Straight autograph from Mr. Good gonna cost you $45, the bodyguard pointed out. For all his girth, height, and general monstrousness, his voice was gentle, patient. The man paid, basically, to suffer fools. Maintain a fool-free perimeter around G-Bad without making his employer look like a dick. "How you gonna pay that? You ain't even have eight."
"Buddy, hey, yo," Stallings said,
Then got the name right again with another painful flash, painful to Mr. Nostalgia, at any rate, of that Scrimshaw smile. Whatever the man had been doing, apart from simply getting old, to have so brutally pared himself down, hollowed himself out since his glory days, it didn't seem to affect his memory. Or maybe he wasn't doing it anymore. I wonder, going all in with a question mark this time, if maybe I could persuade you to help me out? Mr. Nostalgia stepped back, an involuntary move ingrained by years of tangling with the hustlers, operators, schnorrers, and short change artists who flecked the world of card shows like weevils and flour. Thinking there was a difference of more than $37 between offering to pick up the price of admission, a gesture of respect, and springing for the man to buy himself, of all things, a Gibson Good autograph. Mr. Nostalgia tried to remember if he had ever seen or even heard of a celebrity, however well forgotten, who was prepared to stand in line to pay cash for another celebrity's signature. Why did Stallings want it? Where was he going to have G-Bad put it? He did not appear to be carrying any obvious signables, book, photograph, jersey, not even a program, a napkin, a post-it. I just want to get with him. To what end? Mr. Nostalgia never could have flourished in his trade without maintaining a keen ear for the slick lines of grifters and bullshit artists. And Luther Stallings was definitely setting off klaxons, up to something, working some angle. Had already blown his play, in fact, until Mr. Nostalgia for some reason had felt it necessary to leave the safety of his neighborhood and stick his nose where it didn't belong. Mr. Nostalgia could hear his wife passing the sole necessary judgment on the matter, another in the string of endless variations on her single theme. What in God's name were you thinking? But Mr. Nostalgia's title was not a mere honorific. His DBA was his DNA. Remembering the weight of that elephant of happiness upon him on that Saturday afternoon at the Carson Twin in 1974, he chose to believe in the truth of Luther Stallings. A man could want things far stranger and less likely than a quarterback's signature on a scrap of cash register tape or a torn paper bag. Maybe I could do better than that, Mr. Nostalgia said. He reached into the back pocket of his denim shorts and took out a folded, sweat-dampened manila envelope. Inside it were the other two green badges on lanyards to which, at his level of participation, he was entitled. He fished out one badge and pushed his way through the screen of goons. Luther Stallings bowed his head, revealing an incipient Nelson Mandela bald spot. And Mr. Nostalgia bestowed the badge on him, Oz emboldening the lion. Mr. Stallings is working for me today, he said. That's right, Stallings said at once, sounding not just sincere, but impatient, like he had been looking forward for days to helping out in Mr. Nostalgia's booth. His eyes had flicked barely across the badge as Mr. Nostalgia hung it on him. He said, not missing a trick, in Mr. Nostalgia's neighborhood.
Working how? Said the older of the two goons.
He's doing a signing at my booth, Mr. Nostalgia said. I got a complete and a partial set, no Bruce Lee, of the Masters of Kung Fu series. I got a few other things Mr. Stallings has kindly consented to sign. A lobby card from Black Eye, I'm pretty sure.
Masters of Kung Fu,
Stallings repeated, barely managing to avoid sounding like he had absolutely no idea what Mr. Nostalgia was talking about. Don Russ, 1976. It's a tough set. Four clueless looks sought enlightenment at the hands of Mr. Nostalgia. Guys, Mr. Nostalgia said, with a circular sweep of his hands, taking in the echoing space all around them. Trading cards, little rectangles of cardboard, stained with bubble gum. Pop one in the spokes of your bicycle. Make it sound like a Harley Davidson.
Damn, seriously?
Stallings could not keep it back.
Masters of Kung Fu. They got a Luther Stallings in there?
Naturally, Mr. Nostalgia said.
Luther Stallings.
The older of the two blue blazers, lank dark hair, the flowerpot skull, and triangle chin of a Russian or a Pole, about Mr. Nostalgia's age, tried out the name, scrunching up one side of his face like he was screwing a loop into his eye socket.
Oh, okay, yeah. What's it? Strutter. Seriously, that's you?
My first part, Stalling said, seizing upon this unexpected opportunity to preen, loving it, putting one of those massive antler hands on Mr. Nostalgia to let him know he was loving it, doing what he must do best, restoring the goon squad to their proper roles as members of the Luther Stalling's Irregulars. Year after won the title.
Title in what? Kung Fu?
Wasn't one at that time. Was in karate. In Manila. World champion.
World champion bullshit, said Good's bodyguard. I give you that.
Stallings flat ignored the big man. Miss Nostalgia, feeling fairly balls out, pleased with himself, tried to do the same.
We all done here, gentlemen? Stallings asked the Blue Blazers.
The security guys in the Blue Blazers checked in with the bodyguard, who shook his head disgusted.
I tell you what, Luther,
the bodyguard said.
You even flick a boogie in Mr. Good's general vicinity, I'll come down on you, motherfucker. And I will show no mercy.
The man turned and, with a forbearing hitch in his walk, rolled back to the signing table where his boss, head shaved to stubble, wearing a black polo shirt with the red paw print where the alligator would have gone, armed with nothing but a liquid silver marker and a high-priced smile, sat fighting his way through an impressively long line of autograph seekers. Game-worn jerseys, game-used footballs, cards, ball caps. He was going to clear 9-10,000 a day.
Yeah, whatever, Stallings said, as if he could not care less about Gibson Good.
Working up a surprising amount of swagger, he followed Miss Nostalgia to the booth. You would have thought the man had just saved himself from being tossed out of the building by the goon squad. Mr. Nostalgia recognized objectively that he ought to be annoyed, but somehow it made him feel sorrier for Stallings.
Wow, check this shit out.
Stallings worked his gaze along the table, taking in the sealed wax packs of Garbage Pail Kids and Saturday Night Fever, the unopened box of Flair Dune cards, the Daktari and Gentle Ben and Mark and Mindy board games, the talking Batman alarm clock, the Aurora model kits of the Spindrift and Seaview in the original shrink wrap.
They even got cards for that Alf, huh? He said.
His voice as he made this observation, like his expression as he took it all in, sounded unhappy to Mr. Nostalgia, even forlorn. Not the disdain that Mr. Nostalgia's wife always showed for his stock and trade, but something more like disappointment.
Used to be pretty standard for a hit show, Mr. Nostalgia said, wondering when Stallings would get around to hitting him up for the $45. Nothing much of interest in that set.
Though Mr. Nostalgia loved the things he sold, he had no illusion that they held any intrinsic value. They were worth only what you would pay for them. What small piece of everything you ever lost that, you might come to believe, they would restore to you. Their value was indexed only to the sense of personal completeness, perfection of the soul, that would flood you when, at last, you filled the last gap on your checklist. But Mr. Nostalgia had never seen his non-sports cards so sharply disappoint a man.
Alf, yeah, I remember that one, Stallings said. That's real nice. Growing pains, Mark and Mindy, uh-huh. Where the masters of Kung Fu at?
Mr. Nostalgia went around to a bin he had tucked under the table that morning after setting up and dug around inside of it. After a minute of moving things around in the bin, he came out with the partial set, the one that was missing the Lee and the Norris cards.
52 cards in the set, he said. Your number, I don't know, 12, I think it is.
Stallings shuffled through the cards, whose imagery depicted, bordered by cartoon bamboo, labeled with takeout menu-style fake Chinese lettering, a fairly indiscriminate mixture of real and fictitious practitioners. Takeyuki Kubota, Shang-Chi, of a dozen forms of martial arts in addition to the eponymous one, including Bartitsu, Sherlock Holmes, and Savat, Count Baruzi. At last, Stallings came up with his card, stared at the picture, made a sound like a snort through his nose. The card featured a color still from one of his movies, poorly reproduced. A young Luther Stallings, in red kung fu pajamas, flew across the frame toward a line of Chinese swordsmen, feet first, almost horizontal.
"Damn," Stallings said. "I don't even remember what that's from."
"Take it," Mr. Nostalgia said. "Take the whole set. It's a present from me to you, for all the pleasure your work has given me over the years."
"How much you get for it?"
"Well, the set, like I said, it's pretty tough. I'm asking $5, but I probably take $3. Might go for $750 with the Bruce Lee, the Chuck Norris."
"Chuck Norris? Yeah, I went up against the motherfucker 3 times. No joke. Kicked his ass all over Taipei."
Miss Nostalgia figured he could look it up later if he wanted to break some small, previously unbroken place in his own leaf-buried heart.
"Go on," he said. "It's yours."
"Yeah, hey, thanks. That's really nice. But, no offense. I'm already so, like, overburdened. You know what I'm saying? With stuff out of the past I'm carrying around."
"Oh, no, sure.
I just hate to add to the pile."
"I totally understand."
"Gotta keep mobile."
"Of course."
"Travel light."
"Righto."
"How much?" Luther Stallings said, lowering his voice to a near whisper. Swallowing, starting over. Louder the second time.
"How much you get for my card by itself?"
"Oh, Mr. Nisauta said, understanding a microsecond or two too late to pull off the lie that he was going to have to tell.
$100? $90? $100.
"No shit. Like around 90?
"Uh-huh.
Tell you what. You give me this one card, Luther Stallings, in, I'm going to make a wild guess and say it was, Enter the Panther."
"Has to be."
Mr. Nostalgia felt the play begin again. The game that Luther Stallings was trying to run on him and, somehow, on Gibson Good.
"And I'm going to sign it, okay?"
Here it came.
"Then I'm going to trade it back to you for $45.
"Okay,"
Mr. Nostalgia said, feeling unaccountably saddened, crushed by the pachyderm weight of a grief that encompassed him and Stallings and every man plying his lonely way in this hall through the molder and dust of the bins. The world of card shows has always felt like a kind of true fellowship to Mr. Nostalgia, a league of solitary men united in their pursuit of the lost glories of a vanished world. Now that vision struck him as pie in the sky at best, and as falsehood at the very worst. The past was irretrievable. The League of Lonely Men of fiction. The pursuit of the past, a doomed attempt to run a hustle on mortality.
"If that's how you want it," Mr. Nostalgia said. He was not averse, in principle, to raising the $5 value of the Stallings card by a factor of 3 or 4. But as he handed Stallings the gold-filled cross pen, a bar mitzvah gift from his grandparents that he liked to use when he was getting something signed for his own collection, he wished that he had never come out from behind the table, had let the security guards sweep Luther Stallings past Mr. Nostalgia's neighborhood and clear on out of the Kaiser Center. Over the course of the next half hour, he checked on Stallings a couple of times as the man made his way to the end of the signing line for Gibson Good. Then inched his way to the front, one lonely man at a time. In the middle of selling a 1936 Wolverine gum card, The Fight with the Shark, for $550 to a dentist from Danville, Mr. Nostalgia happened to glance over and see that Luther Stallings had regained his place at the front. The bodyguard got to his feet looking ready, as promised, to suspend mercy. But after a brown out of his smile, Gibson Good reached for the bodyguard and gently stiff-armed him, palm to the big man's chest, and the big man, with a mighty headshake, stepped off. Words passed between Good and Stallings, quietly, without agitation. To Mr. Nostalgia,
reading lips and gestures, sometimes able to pick up a word, a phrase, the conversation seemed to boil down to Gibson Good saying no repeatedly, with blank politesse, while Luther Stallings tried to come up with new ways of getting Good to say yes. There was only so much of this that the people in line behind Luther Stallings were willing to put up with. A rumor of Stallings' earlier outburst, his near ejection, began to circulate among them. There was a certain amount of moaning and kvetching. Somebody gave voice to the collective desire for Stallings to, "Come on!" Stallings ignored it all. "You asked him?" he said, raising his voice as he had done an hour ago, when the Blue Blazers came to see how he might like to try getting himself tossed. "You asked him about popcorn?" Talking loudly enough for Mr. Nostalgia and everybody in the neighborhood to hear. "Then I got the man for you, hooked him. You know I did." The expressions of impatience, general down the line, rose to outright jeering. Stallings turned on the crowd, trying to scowl them into silence, snapping at a man in a Hawaiian shirt standing two guys behind him. The man said, "No! Fuck you!" Wading into the signing area, arms windmilling to reach for Stallings in a kind of freestyle of aggression, came the two Blue Blazers, Shaved Ball and the Soviet. They took brusque hold of Stallings' arms, faces compressed as if to resist a stink, and jerked his arms back and toward his spine. 2 seconds later, no more. Shaved Ball and the Soviet were lying flat on their backs on the painted cement floor of the hall. Mr. Nostalgia could not have said for certain which of them had taken the kick to the head, which the punch to the abdomen, or if Luther Stallings had even moved very much at all. As they had gone tumbling backward, the line of autograph seekers had shuddered, rippled. Human turbulence troubled all the surrounding lines, people waiting for Chris Mullen, Sean Green. "Bitch," Stallings said, turning back to Gibson Good in his polo shirt with his sockless loafers. "I want my 25 grand." Gibson Good, being Gibson Good, Mr. Nostalgia supposed, might have no choice in the matter. He kept, as his legend said he must, his cool. The same quiet, restraining hand against his bodyguard's chest, unintimidated, still smiling. He took out his wallet, opened it, and counted out 10 bills, rapid fire, slid them across the signing table. Luther Stallings studied them, head down, chest rising and falling. The money lay there, exciting comment in the line, 10 duplicate cards from the highly collectible Dead Presidents series. Luther shook his head once, then reached down and took the money. Resigned, long since resigned, Mr. Nostalgia thought, to doing things he knew he was going to regret. When he went past Mr. Nostalgia's table without so much as a thank you, he had not managed to get his chin up again. It was only later, as a voice on the PA was chasing stragglers from the hall and the lights went out over the signing area, that Mr. Nostalgia noticed Luther Stallings had walked off with his gold pen. On a Saturday night in August 1973, outside the Bitter Honey Lounge, a crocodile green 70 Tornado sat purring its crocodile purr, its chrome grin stretched beguiling and wide as the western horizon. "Define Tornado," said the man riding shotgun. Behind his heavy-rimmed glasses, he had sleepy eyes, but he scorned sleep and frowned upon the somnolence of others. In defiance of political fashion, he greased his long hair, and its undulant luster was clear-coat deep. His name was Chandler Banquell Flowers III. His grandfather, father, and uncles were all morticians, men of sobriety and pomp, and he inhabited a floating yet permanent zone of rebellion against them. 19 months aboard the Bonhomme Richard had left Chan Flowers with an amphetamine habit and a tattoo of Tuffy the Ghost on the inside of his left forearm. The shotgun, holstered in a plastic trash bag alongside his right leg, was a pump-action Mossberg 500. "Define it," said the driver, Luther Stallings, not giving the matter his full attention. His eyes, green-flecked with gold, kept finding excuses to visit the rearview mirror. "It's the name of a car." "But what does it mean? What is the definition of the word tornado? Tell me that." "You tell me," Luther said,
More wary now?
It's a question. Yeah, but what are you really asking?
Tornado.
Chan strumming the R like a string of Ricky Ricardo's guitar.
You're driving it, talking about it, in love with it, don't even know what it means.
Luther massaged the leather cover on the steering wheel as if feeling for a cyst. He took another glance in the mirror, then leaned forward to look past Chan at the bit of honey's front door. Where Chan ran to dark and stocky, Luther Stallings was long and light-skinned, with an astronaut chin. He had served one tour in the U.S. Army, most of it spent splintering planks with his feet for a hand-to-hand combat demonstration team. He was dressed as for dancing, tight plaid bell-bottom slacks, a short-sleeved terry pullover. His hair rose, freshly stoked, into a momentous afro.
"I believe it's Spanish," Luther said, "a common expression. Can be loosely translated to suck my dick."
"Vulgar language," Chan said, drawing on his rich patrimony of improving maxims. That stiff mortuary grammar, hand-beaten into him by his old man, had always embarrassed him when they were youngsters. In this hoodlum revolutionary phase he was going through, Chan flaunted the properness of his speech, a lily in the lapel of a black leather car coat.
"Always the first and last refuge of the man with nothing to say."
Luther broke free of the mirror to look at Chan.
"Toronado," he said, employing the imperative. "You don't know, do you?" Chan said. "Just admit. You are driving around. You paid $3,000 for this vehicle. Cash. For all you know, a Toronado's what? Might be some kind of brush you use for cleaning a Mexican toilet bowl."
"I don't care what it... Juanita, quick, get the Toronado. I have diarrhea."
"It means a bullfighter,"
Luther said, rising to the bait despite long experience, despite needing to keep one eye on the rear view and one on the diamond-tufted vinyl door of the lounge, in spite of wanting to be 100 years and 1,000 miles away from this place and this night.
"A fighter of bulls."
"In Spanish,"
Chan suggested in a mock helpful tone. Luther shrugged. When Chan was nervous, he got bored, and when he got bored, he would start trouble. Any kind of trouble, just to break the tedium. But there was more to this line of questioning. Chan was mad at Luther and trying to hide it. He had been trying for days to hold his anger close, like the Spartan boy with the fox in his shirt, let it feast on his intestines rather than cop to hiding it.
"Bullfighter," Chan said with bitter precision, "is torero."
He bent down to scoop a handful of 12-gauge cartridges from a box between his feet and pocketed them at the hip of his tweed blazer. His hair, heavy with pomade, gave off a dismaying odor of flowers left too long in a vase, putrid as envy itself.
"Then, tornado," Luther tried.
This was such a contemptible suggestion that Chan, who generally never lacked for verbal expressions of contempt, could dignify it only with a smirking shake of his head. Luther was about to point out that it was he, the ignorant one, who just laid down $3,200 bills for the beautiful car with the mysterious name, while Professor Flowers remained a frequent denizen of the buses.
"Chan, you captious motherfucker," he began, but then stopped.
From another pocket of his tweed blazer, patches on the elbows, Chan drew a pair of sateen gloves, dark purplish blue, shoddy things, busted at the seams, tricked out with pointy fish fins. Last Halloween, Chan's little brother, Marcel, out trick-or-treating in a Batman suit, had been hit by a car and killed. Drunken Negroes and a rambler American, boys stepping off the curb with his face too small to really fit the eye holes of the mask. Chan had some tiny hands, but even so, the gloves were a tight fit, and as he pulled them on, they split some more. When Luther saw Chan wearing Marcel's purple crime-fighting gloves, he didn't know what to say. He threw another glance at the rear view. Telegraph Avenue Nocturne, a submarine wobble of light and shadow. Chan reached into the garbage bag, came out with a bad-aired mask, stamped from flimsy plastic. He slipped the elastic string over the back of his head, parked the borrowed face at the top of his forehead.
Okay, Luther said at last. The second smartest boy in the room every day of his life from 1955 to the day in 1971 that had Chan shipped out. Tell me what it means.
A girl, at key points also constructed like the car along a beguiling X-axis, came out of the Bitter Honey Lounge. She wore tight white jeans whose flared legs bellied like sails. Her hair was tied back shiny against her head to emerge aft in a big puffball. Her feet rode the howdahs of swaying platform sandals. As she sauntered past the car, she pulled the tails of her short-sleeved madras shirt from the waist of her jeans, knotting them together under her breasts. That's it, Luther said. He pressed down on the clutch and readied his hand on the gear shift. Go if you're going. Chan lowered the mask over his face, and Luther saw that it had been painted top to bottom, matte black paint effacing the line that marked the bottom edge of Batman's cowl, paint sprayed over the heroic molded chin dimple, the affable molded smile. Behind the mask, Chan's eyes glistened like organs exposed by two incisions. Jungle action, Chan said behind the baffle of the mask. Oh, and by the way, he shouldered open the passenger door and sprang out of the car. The shotgun in the garbage bag hung by his side like a workaday implement. Tornado doesn't mean shit. Chan's right arm snaked into the mouth of the garbage bag as, with his left hand, he grabbed hold of the brass handle of the upholstered front door of the club. He yanked the door open, flinging his right arm out to the side. The garbage bag flew off, revealing the riot gun that Chan had checked out that afternoon from the basement arsenal of a Panther safe house in East Oakland. There was a gust of horns, palaver, and thump, and then the door breathed shut behind Chan.